Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. I am Jamie Snowden with John.
Dude, we're never going to be able to leave.
I know.
You may not even get out of my driveway.
Yeah, I definitely had to use four-wheel drive to get from my house to yours, which is next door. I could have just walked, but then I would have had to get some snowshoes. So
I did walk to the end of our driveway and back, and I don't know that the kids will be in school for at least a week.
I saw your footprints. I was wondering who you... I thought you might have made your kids go out there or something. It was. I was a little worried about them.
No, but it's the kind of weather that, like, they may be hurt if they go out. We've got branches falling from the ice, and there's a lot of people in Kentucky who probably need some help.
Who probably don't have power. So hopefully everybody's all right. So we're going to settle in and tell you a crime story. If your power's out, put it on your phone. Light up a fire, and let's get crimey.
Yeah. Jamie, I do want to say thank you first to a new Patreon member, and that is Jamie, not you.
Not me.
But Jamie will be featured on an upcoming interview. You want to say more about that?
Yeah. Jamie Sell is a lady who is fighting for justice for her son, who she claims was wrongfully convicted of a murder. So we will have her on next Monday to talk about that. So you make sure, I won't give any more details now, but let her share her story. So
just to be clear, we didn't make her join Patreon to get her story out there.
No.
She did this out of the goodness
of
her heart.
Super kind of you.
We almost wish Jamie wouldn't have, because we're just honored to try what we can to get that story out there.
Absolutely. So we look forward to that. That'll be next Monday. We got a couple bonus episodes coming up on Mondays, but got some good stuff coming up on the regular show too.
Yeah, absolutely. Jamie, why don't you get the ball rolling?
We're going to go to Germany today. So buckle up for the names, guys.
Yeah. Just give me some grace.
Anna Montez was born February 28th, 1957 at the Army Hospital in Nuremberg, West Germany. Her dad, Albert, was posted there as a U.S. Army doctor. 16 months later, she had a younger sister that was born. Her name was Luz. She was born there in the Army Hospital. And the family moved over to the States on August 26, 1958, where they made a home in Topeka, Kansas. It was there that they had another child, Tito, who was born in 1959. 8 years later, the family moved to Towson, Maryland, where the children finished school. As far as their home life goes, the Montez kids say they experienced physical and emotional abuse from their father from the time that they were raised early in their lives in West Germany, in Kansas, and throughout their childhood into Maryland.
In 1975, Anna enrolled at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And just a personal side note, I've got family that go to school there, so kind of story close to home. She initially majored in history, but after 2 years, she would change her major to foreign affairs. She would spend her junior year studying abroad in Spain, and during that time, she met a man named Ricardo Fernandez Irez. Now, he was a leftist from Argentina, and the two began a relationship. Ricardo would talk with Anna about the U.S. support for authoritarian governments, and these conversations started helping Anna shape her political outlook. It's during college where you find out who you are,
right?
Who am I?
And what do I believe now that I've been away from my family? How much of that do I hold on to, and how much of that do I actually want to evolve?
Absolutely. So while she was in Spain, the country transitioned to democracy after their dictator had died. And Anna participated in street rallies protesting American support for their former dictator. She wrote letters to her sister and telling them about a growing interest in Cuba. And even though her relationship with Ricardo ended, she continued to be attracted to basically communist ideas.
Yeah. After graduation in 1979, and this is super, I don't want to say popular, but common, that like the 70s were a big time of movement for these types of things. But after she graduated, she moved to Puerto Rico, where she worked as a receptionist at a law firm. But by the end of the year, she had moved to Washington, D.C. to work as a clerk, a typist, with the U.S. Department of Justice. So she has gone from being an activist to actually working in the government in the area that she wanted to see improve. And that was the beginning of a 22-year-long career in U.S. government. So initially, I'm like, well, did she change her mind? Did she decide to change things from within? You know, it's I think people do both as they're discovering who they are. When she joined the government, the FBI did a background check, but didn't find any evidence of the contempt that she had shown for the U.S. government through standing up against them for what they had done to support the dictator of Argentina. After just 3 years, she was promoted to paralegal at the Department of Justice. In 1982, she started a two-year master's program at Johns Hopkins University in their School of Advanced International Studies. So foreign affairs seemed to be her love. And there she concentrated on Latin American studies and made friends with fellow student Marta Velasquez. Marta was described as a radical leftist who had studied political science and Latin American studies at Princeton University. And again, this is the 80s, right? We're coming out of Vietnam. We're getting into Cold War times. So things are tense in the 70s and 80s internationally. And America is pretty guarded. So anybody who speaks out against America was probably regarded as a radical at that time.
Well, it turns out Marta became a Cuban agent in 1983. So she traveled from Washington to Mexico City to meet with Cuban intelligence service officers and or their agents. So she assisted Cuban intelligence by spotting, assessing, and recruiting U.S. citizens who occupy sensitive national security positions or had the potential to do so later. On December 16th, 1984, Ava went to dinner in Manhattan with Marta and a Cuban intelligence officer. Anna did not hesitate to say that she would work with the Cubans to help Nicaragua.
In case there's any question of what's happening here, Marta has become a spy for Cuba, and her job is to recruit U.S. citizens to give them vital information. So
Anna was perfect for this, too, because she worked for the organization. But she didn't like she was like a Ron Swanson who could easily be targeted to work against the government,
right,
even though she was technically an insider.
So Marta, who she had met in grad school, essentially talked Anna into being an agent.
Yeah.
Or an asset, for Cuban intelligence.
I mean, I think you could really see this coming. I mean, she met Ricardo and was just kind of swept away with his ideology, but then ended up working for the government. So perfection if you're right. Marta.
And again, we landed here, but was this her intent all along, or did it just happen to work out well? I don't know. Maybe we can process that at the end.
Yeah, she had already told all of her classmates that she had a moral opposition to the U.S. policies in Nicaragua. Anna went on to apply for a job at the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is a segment of the Pentagon that gathered intelligence. By 1985, Anna was fully recruited and became a spy in the Pentagon.
So she is gone.
Where you would, the last place you would want a spy is the Pentagon. And that's where she's at.
Starts as a law clerk, works as a paralegal, gets recruited to Cuba and is like, I need to be a spy. Can I be a spy? And they're like, yeah, come be a spy. So
yeah,
it's she is currently kind of a double agent. So within weeks of Anna agreeing to spy for the Cuban government, her sister Luz began working as a language specialist with the FBI. So this family is infiltrating the government. And obviously, Anna's she is up to no good for the American best interest.
I really hope that Luz becomes like a good guy in this story, you know, but we'll see.
Yeah, it could be a sibling rivalry. Anna wasn't happy that she started working for the FBI. But she went with Marta to Spain for what looked like a spring break trip. And while they were there, Anna and Marta met with Cuban agents who gave false passports that they used to fly to Prague and then to Cuba. Once there, Anna and Marta received training and espionage from Cuban agents who had learned their skills from the Soviets. So, in case you're not familiar, Soviets were kind of our rival during the Cold War, and Cuba was allied with them. We had the Cuban Missile Crisis and all the bad things.
So basically, and you tell me if I'm wrong because I'm asking a question instead of telling information. Basically, Cuba, super close to America, if they're allies with Russia, that would be a perfect place for the Russians or Soviets to put missiles that could be launched from there to basically anywhere in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, it's great access to America.
Basically, the modern-day Greenland.
Pretty much. I mean, too soon.
I'm not trying to say anything for or against it. I'm saying that's pretty much the situation.
They're like 3 miles from Alaska, but apparently they don't care, right? Who cares? Like, I love Alaska. Leave them alone. But the Russians were going through Cuba to try to hit to the heart of the U.S., and this is when they taught Anna and Marta to communicate with handlers through encrypted high-frequency shortwave radio messages coming from Havana. They also learned to detect if they were being watched and to keep away from people who were surveilling them. Anna and Marta also requested practice polygraph tests so that if they were pressed for a security screening for classified positions, then they could pass it and continue to move up in the U.S. government. So this is a very thorough spy training, right? And I don't know. I would love to be trained in these things. But you know who I don't want trained in these things? People who hate my country or hate me, right?
Yeah, especially people who already work for our country.
After their training, they came back to U.S. the same way that they got to Cuba. They used those passports to get home, and then they showed up at work on Monday.
Anna was a model employee. She was dependable. She was punctual and very detail-oriented. But no one really knew that she was working two jobs. During the day, Anna was a hardworking analyst for the Defense Intelligence Agency, or also known as the DIA, which is like the CIA equivalent for the U.S. military. She spent her days with her head down memorizing classified documents. Then she'd go home to her Washington, D.C. apartment and start her second job. Essentially, she would upload all the intelligence that she memorized that day to an old Toshiba laptop. She encrypted it, wait a couple of weeks, then passed that information to her Cuban handlers, who she would meet at restaurants in the D.C. area. Anna looked for positions at work that would provide access to more classified information, practically anything that would involve the Civil War there in Nicaragua. I would imagine she's probably getting paid pretty well, too, for all this information.
Absolutely. Spies were offered just boatloads of money to cooperate and give U.S. intelligence. To be honest, I'm not super familiar with the Civil War in Nicaragua, but obviously it was a big deal to Cuba. They had a vested interest in that. Now, Anna's supervisors at the DIA requested that she be granted sensitive compartmented information clearance, which is one level higher than top secret. I'm not a genius. I'm not a spy. But doesn't top secret seem like it should be the highest level?
I think it's the top, you know? It should be the most secret.
It should be, but it's not. So this is higher than top secret, and this is information that...
It's like we don't even speak of this.
Right. The way the government handles sensitive information is they compartmentalize people in different departments, and they don't know what each other is doing. So, like, I can be working on this widget that if you combine it with somebody else's widget is going to make some kind of weapon, or I can be working on a traffic plan that somebody else is working on infiltrating a country that they go hand in hand, but they don't know.
When you put the two together, they've made something. They just don't know what until it happens.
But she has information kind of to the gamut to see the big picture. And that's above top secret. So it's tip top secret. She would have had access to some of the Department of Defense's most closely guarded information at a time when information was very, very closely guarded. She was also meeting with her Cuban handlers at Chinese restaurants every 2 to 3 weeks on weekends. I have no interest in being a spy, but if somebody wants to invite me to Chinese every couple of weeks,
if that is like a norm, we would probably be on an FBI watch list about 3 years ago, you know?
Oh, these guys are just always
all the time.
They're at the buffet every day. So she limited the number of documents that she removed to try not to get caught and to keep a low profile, which is something that she was taught to do and very smart for somebody trying to be sneaky. At one point, she gave her handlers a DIA phone directory. So now they have access to the individuals that are working there, what positions people are in, and what they're doing. She also passed along classified photographs, classified memos, and any other information she could get her hands on. But she wanted to limit her chances of getting caught, so she started just passing on what she could memorize to avoid a paper trail, which I have to wonder how happy Cuba was with that, because, of course, they don't want her to get caught. They don't want to lose their asset, but at the same time, it's not necessarily as good as what she had been providing. By the end of the 80s, the DIA considered Anna one of their top employees. She was producing top secret reports that were lauded by policymakers, military departments, and members of the intelligence community. So she is like turning into the A-plus student as far as, I don't know, she's a top employee. She has high clearance. She's a very trusted asset for America. Unfortunately, also a trusted asset for Cuba. So how do we find out about all this? We'll get to it after the break.
I really had like VH1 vibes behind the music, you know?
Yeah.
She was a top employee, but backstage, things were falling apart.
Yeah. She was sabotaging the entire industry.
Yep. So Anna had another sister named Lucy. So she married a guy named Chris Manigarcina, who managed the auto fleet at the FBI Miami's field office. He was preparing to join the FBI as a white-collar financial crime investigator. That's a big leap, right? You manage the auto fleet, but then you're also preparing to become like this investigator. Like, That's pretty cool.
Like, sir, what? Just tell us what you were doing last week. I'm glad you're here at the financial crime unit. I was changing oil out there, making sure all the FBI cars was good to go.
It seems like a jump, but, you know, kudos. That same year, Anna's brother, Tito, and his wife, Joan, were all offered positions as clerks at the Miami FBI field office. This family is just like blue bloods, you know? It's like everybody is in the family business. Many would later go on to become special agents. Anna was working as a double agent, while four of her family members also worked for the FBI. In fact, in her work as a translator, Anna's sister Luz was assigned to be a special unit looking for Cuban spies.
Whoa.
So her own sister has a job to be looking for the very likes of Anna.
This sounds like a made-up crime novel or spy movie.
That is going to be an awkward Thanksgiving.
Right? You know? Hey, anybody know any Cuban spies? Could you pass the gravy?
This is going to be a train wreck. So she had no idea that her own sister was secretly becoming the greatest spy in Cuban history. In February of 1993, Anna was selected to oversee the DIA's Cuba account and became a long-term Cuba analyst. This is just a match made in heaven for Anna, but a match made in hell for the United States of America. From then on, she deliberately invited herself to any meeting that involved Cuba. Anna became the intelligence community's leading expert on Cuba's military, leadership, weapons, and so much more. She was actually called the Queen of Cuba.
And she was also Cuba's leading expert on American weaponry and plans. So she is in, I mean, if they could have picked somebody to be an asset, they would have been like, can we have that person? Obviously not, but they did. It's absolutely perfect for them.
And this started years before, and it's crazy to believe that she made her way to this position in government going completely undetected.
I don't think anybody could have predicted it, but that's where it ended up. So great for Cuba, not great for the United States. Meanwhile, she continued to work her second job by using shortwave radio to tune into pre-established frequencies. So think of a radio, and she's got these secret frequencies with secret codes that come in at precisely 9 p.m. or 10 p.m., depending on the day, on Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays, a voice would announce "Atención," and then it would recite hundreds of random numbers. She would put these numbers in her Toshiba, where a Cuban-installed decryption program converted them into language text, Spanish specifically. The messages would have instructions straight from Havana, Cuba. These broadcasters were nearly impossible to break without the cryptographic key that Anna had and was in the software. Plus, they were transmitted openly, so it was difficult to figure out who the messages were meant for. They could find out who they were coming from, but who's out there listening, which of these means something, and her cryptographic key could have been different than somebody else's. This is really good spy work, to be honest. When Anna needed to contact her Cuban handler, she would use payphones to call pagers and use coded systems in the messages that she left. She kept the codes for each message on water-soluble paper that would be destroyed instantly after she got the information that she needed. This is top-level spy crap.
Absolutely. It makes me think of the numbers that were being repeated on Lost, but it's just hundreds of and hundreds of numbers that she had the code for.
So 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42.
Yeah, that was precisely it. The ones.
I have problems.
I used to love trying to decipher codes, mm-hmm. but this was brilliant. I mean, this would go out. Anybody with this kind of radio could listen to them. But the problem, like you said, is they had no idea. Basically, if I tuned in, I don't know where this is coming from or who it's meant for. And mm-hmm. I certainly don't have the decoder, if you will. In March of 1994, Anna successfully passed a DIA-administered counterintelligence polygraph exam that was basically designed to detect any kind of espionage, sabotage, or unauthorized disclosure of classified information. It was the only polygraph that Anna ever took in her career with the U.S. government. So they had one shot, and they blew it.
But remember, she had trained. She had asked specifically for polygraph training.
So shortly after that, she gave the Cubans the identity of a covert U.S. intelligence officer who was preparing to travel to Cuba undercover. Then, ironically, in May of 1995, Anna's sister, Luz, was assigned to the Royal Flush Task Force. That sounds like a poker thing and not, like a secret, task force.
I mean, it sounds like if you're selected for it, you're pretty baller. Royal Flushes are above top secret, if you will.
This was a secret operations that was ran by the FBI, NSA, and the Navy to investigate Cuban espionage in Miami. It seemed like the walls were closing in on Anna. In February of 1996, the Cuban Air Force shot down two unarmed aircraft, and Anna was called in the next day to help evaluate what the U.S. should do. She was assigned to a task force at the Pentagon that morning around 11 a.m. Usually, people who work on these task forces are not permitted to leave until they are officially dismissed, usually around 10 p.m. However, around 8 p.m., Anna received a phone call that clearly upset her, so she claimed she was reaching exhaustion and left. This immediately raised suspicions in the room. Less than 2 days after the attack, a Cuban handler broke protocol and waited for Anna on the street, flagged down her on her way to work, asking if the U.S. was planning on launching cruise missiles at Cuba in retaliation.
In April of 96, a coworker of Anna's reached out to Scott Carmichael, who was a DIA officer who specialized in mole hunting. Wouldn't that be a cool job of being a spy and your only job was to find moles?
Yeah, and not the agents. Little cute little things in your yard, but bad guys.
Or not like in Austin Powers 3 when Fred Savage has a mole.
I forgot about that.
Moly moly. So he was voicing his concerns about Anna, which is the first time that suspicions were actually surfaced about her. He cited her need to be involved in everything that came up about Cuba and the odd phone call that she received before immediately leaving the task force one night. And again, they didn't leave until they were cleared. This wasn't a, hey, I'm going to drop by the office for a while. It was an official shift, essentially, she was on. It took 6 months and more allegations from this coworker before the FBI allowed Carmichael to go in and interview Anna. And remember, she had passed the polygraph, so I think she probably thought, hey, I passed that, I'm in the clear. On November 7th of 1996, Carmichael questioned Anna about her involvement in a Cuban intelligence influence operation. Of course, she denied all the allegations, instead deflecting attention on a Georgetown University professor that she said she believed was a spy for Cuba. Carmichael could tell that she was deflecting and believed she was hiding something, but he didn't have enough evidence to do anything about it. Anna continued to do her work and continued to have access to highly classified projects above top secret, which she later exposed to Cuba. In 1997, she received the National Intelligence Certificate of Distinction, and in that same year, she exposed the identities of more covert U.S. intelligence officers in Cuba, putting their lives at risk. Now, look, if you feel like America was doing stuff wrong at this time, you have your right to speak up about that. You may even support somebody sharing information. But when these individuals, and spies usually have to do this, this is how they earn trust, they give names of other spies that end up getting killed. And that's happened in other spy cases we've covered. If you're giving names up and getting people killed, I don't know how you defend that. Like, you're getting Americans killed for money. Like, you're paying for that. So it's, I don't know how you defend that. That's where, I don't care what you believe, I feel like that should be a line in the sand.
She continued to visit Cuba and meet with both U.S. officials and her handlers separately. In September of 1998, the task force that her sister had joined announced the arrest of the Cuban Five. So this was a group of five Cuban intelligence officers who were arrested in the U.S. and convicted for conspiracy to commit espionage, conspiracy to commit murder, acting as an agent of a foreign government, and other illegal activities. So it seemed like the Cuban intelligence operations in the U.S. were starting to crumble. On top of that, the FBI recovered the cryptographic keys that decoded the broadcast the Cubans were sending to the agents, like Anna. So this caused the Cubans to cease all operations using that shortwave radio. Anna was instantly cut off from all of her handlers, and the NSA was closing in on a description of the suspected spy. But based on historical precedent, they were first looking for a male suspect. In the shortwave radio communications, the agent was referred to as a male approximately 70% of the time and female only 30% of the time, which further led them in the direction of a male suspect. After 2 years of following leads and profiles, the FBI had not identified any suspects.
You know, there are a lot of female spies. I think they're very effective in ways that men can't be. I would have suspected this number to be more heavily in favor of males. I would expect more males to be traitor than females, more than a 70-30 split. And I don't know if that's just me knowing that men are dumb and would do stuff for money, or I'm basing that off movies. I know this is the first female double agent we've talked about on the show, so maybe that's where I'm getting my vibe. One of the parts of the FBI profile indicated that this suspect would have visited Guantanamo Bay within a 2-week period in July of 1996. So they're saying, we know this person had to be there then. This was when information was shared in a certain way. And that's when a DIA agent named Chris Simmons, specializing in Cuba, contacted Scott Carmichael. Remember, the guy in charge of investigating this. Simmons didn't have the authority to investigate espionage cases himself, so he brought this lead to Carmichael, and they confirmed that Anna had indeed visited Guantanamo Bay in July of 96. However, they still couldn't get the FBI to buy into the idea that this spy was a woman. So Carmichael continued looking into Anna on his own. Another lead from the FBI profile was that the suspect would have met an important person with the initials WD, and they find this out by transmissions, decoding things. So it's they were pretty certain that somebody connected to a WD would come up here. In one of their previous interviews, Anna had told Carmichael that she had worked closely with William Daugherty, the chief of the FBI's counterintelligence section. Carmichael shared this information with Steve McCoy, who was the FBI special agent in charge of finding this spy. And after this information was shared, McCoy started to view Carmichael as a valuable collaborator and started listening to him and pulled him in to kind of help with the case, because he believed that Carmichael had valuable information after he had been sharing that he thought Anna was involved for years, but nobody would listen. Now McCoy is.
I love that he was able to kind of, remember all of the details of that investigation or his interrogation. And, you know, that WD that he remembered would be huge. On October 16th, 2000, McCoy officially opened a preliminary investigation into Anna. Over 50 personnel were assigned to the case. That's a lot. That's a lot of manpower.
In my mind, that converts to dollars. If they're making $50,000 each, you're like, that's so much money. That's $2.5 million of salary focused on catching her, which she's giving away a lot. So maybe it's worth it.
So these people would be, you know, assigned to follow her everywhere, by car, on foot. Basically, with that many people, you know, there's a chance Anna is highly intelligent. She could probably pick up on if she was being tailed by somebody. But to notice that many people, you know, I'm not saying they were all doing it at one time,
right,
but there had to be times where there was 10, 20 people surveilling her, and you can't keep track of all that.
Right.
They recorded her making suspicious calls on payphones, even though she had a cell phone in her bag. They intercepted her mail. They looked through her trash for any kind of evidence they could find. By February 16th, 2001, the FBI were also monitoring her emails, listening to her phone calls, searching her apartment, office, car, her safety deposit box. The FBI even installed hidden cameras and microphones in her home. This is incredible. I'm glad that they're doing this.
I wonder how, I mean, this was right before 9/11, before the Patriot Act. So I wonder if they're having to get warrants for all this. We couldn't find that out, but this is super invasive investigation here.
I cannot remember his name right now. I know it's John something, but he's a former CIA agent. He got in some trouble, and now he does TikToks telling all of CIA secrets, or at least a lot of them.
John Caracu?
Yes. Yep. And he talked about how the FBI, probably at this time, would even have the capability of, they could get into your TV and turn what was a speaker into a microphone.
Right.
So they could get into her apartment without even going into her apartment,
man,
if they really wanted to.
They probably really know how I feel about Kentucky basketball right now. I yell into the TV.
They might have looked into me, but they would have quickly got bored because I'm just watching what they're doing on TikTok from John. So in looking through her credit records, they discovered that Anna had purchased the same model Toshiba laptop that they had seen referenced in a lead from the NSA. On May 25th, 2001, a small team of FBI specialists did a covert search of Anna's apartment, where they found her shortwave radio and the Toshiba laptop hidden under the bed. The hard drive showed 11 pages of incriminating documents, including direct communications between Anna and her Cuban handlers. So it was now clear that Anna was working with Cuba as a spy.
Yeah, hard evidence now, not just speculation or coincidence. This is, they have records on her computer at her home coming from these transmissions from her handlers. So, I mean, once you have this, what do you do with it? You have the option to just move on her and stop her. You also have you have a leg up, so you have the opportunity to take advantage of it. But as we know, September 11th, 2001 changed everything. They were still trying to gather information on what she was doing and take advantage of it. These terrorist attacks, in case you're not familiar and maybe not from America and don't talk about it as much as we do, that's when the Twin Towers in New York City were struck by planes, thousands of Americans died, and really life in our country changed in a major way. So this prompted Anna to place many phone calls that weekend trying to decipher Cuban's potential involvement. And then if they were involved, how did the U.S. intend to retaliate against Cuba? So for several days after September 11th, she was followed as she made more and more phone calls to pagers, particularly from payphones. She tried to warn her handlers that Cuba may be in danger if they had anything to do with this. At work, Anna had been asked to join a task force assisting in efforts against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan, who they identified as having been behind these attacks. And this gave her access to more classified information. She then knew that it wasn't necessarily Cuba that was being targeted or looked into, But the FBI also knew about Anna, so they didn't want to risk her infiltrating the effort in wake of the terrorist attacks and trying to get more information and still use this somehow to benefit Cuba. So in the morning of September 21st, Anna was called to a conference room with the FBI, specifically Agent McCoy, and he interrogated her about her involvement with Cuba. When asked if she was under investigation, she was immediately arrested and charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. This was when she was 44 years old and had been working with the Department of Justice and National Security for about 20 years at this point.
And for 17 of those, she had basically a double life as Cuba's top spy, and it took a toll. She was on antidepressants. She listened to anxiety relief tapes and saw psychiatrists. After her arrest, another search of her apartment showed that she was preparing to flee with a bag of cash and maps in hand. She wasn't well-liked in her office, and people always had noted her laser focus on Havana. But for years, she was able to hide in the government office. So, like, how was she able to do that? Former FBI agent Peter Lapp noted in his book about the subject that people don't totally get the complexity of an investigation like this. In her case, their team had to whittle down suspects from a pool of 1.5 million people who worked at the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Defense, all across the U.S. and different territories. He said, quote, "The process of identifying an UNSUB based on tidbits is incredibly difficult. You put together a matrix, but you have to do it incredibly discreetly because the last thing you want to do is to alert the suspect. That's why these cases are need to know. That's why they are closely held. We are looking for a needle in a haystack," end quote.
And everybody's work's messy because they're all involved in being shady because they're spies for America. So they have things that they're doing that look odd because their jobs are odd, right? But on October 16th of 2002, Anna pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 25 years in prison. After her sentencing, she criticized U.S. policy toward Cuba, calling it cruel and unfair. So starting to let some of her actual intentions and ideas be revealed. She also said that she felt morally obligated to help the island defend itself from our efforts to impose our values and our political system on it. She claimed she had a deep desire to protect Cuba from the U.S. and that all the world is one country. This appears to be true, since aside from paying for her travel expenses, she says, and they could never find, that she actually took payments from Cuba. Her motivation for being a spy and betraying her country was purely ideological. Simmons worked with Anna for years and believes she has no remorse for what she had done. He would say, "I bet right now she's every bit as convinced that one day we'll understand she was right. She'll go to her grave believing that she was wrongfully imprisoned for doing the right thing."
Anna was imprisoned in Fort Worth, Texas, with some pretty notable cellmates. One of those was a female Al-Qaeda terrorist, the cocaine-smuggling wife of the Mexican drug kingpin El Chapo. Another famous person was one of the groupies from the Charles Manson group, Lynette Form, who tried to murder President Gerald Ford. Anna was released on January 6, 2023. She will be monitored, including all of her internet usage, until 2028. Again, mine would just be like so many TikToks, like so many.
Yeah, right.
That's all I do. She will not be allowed to have any contact with any foreign agent or work for the U.S. government without permission. So, I mean, technically, if the U.S. government wanted to, they could recruit her to work, but
she does have a particular set of skills.
I don't know that that will happen, but I guess it is a possibility. Today, she does live in Puerto Rico. She continues to speak out about U.S. relations with Cuba. She's also considered one of the most influential and destructive spies in American history. She revealed the identities of four American undercover intelligence officers who were working in Cuba, and also her handlers about a super secretive stealth satellite that the U.S. government was operating and looking into what Cuba was up to. Jamie, I think the people who felt her betrayal the most were her family. She had siblings and family who spent their careers serving the U.S., and they see everything Anna did as an attack on them as well. And absolutely they should. I mean, they're all trying to live straight-laced lives working for the government, and here's her or their sister or family member basically betraying all of that.
And they've publicly spoken out against her, but you have to wonder, like in the back of my head, she probably spoke out against spies while she was a spy as well. Was she ever tempted at that Thanksgiving table to be like, so guys, I mean, y'all, anybody like Cuba? Raise your hand.
Yeah.
I got an opportunity for you.
Or like asking them, so what are you all working on? You know, right. Tell me more about what you're doing so I can go tell and make some more money.
I don't know if she tried to recruit them, if they were ever suspicious or what, but it's certainly messy. And, you know, she will be monitored through 2028 on her internet usage. That's on the books. I assume it'll be forever. I think it should be forever.
Yeah.
Let's see. She was arrested when she was 44. That was in 2001. So what would she be now? 69 years old, something like that.
Golly, that doesn't sound right.
Yeah. So, yeah, we are very old, John. So, I mean, still old enough to do some serious spy work and share information and try to gain access to some things. So, I mean, I don't think there should be a limit on her probation, her monitoring, or anything. Once somebody does this for so long, then I think it's hard to ever trust them again with anything. So she did her time. I don't know necessarily the undercover agents that she gave the names of. I don't know if they were killed. That was never released. I think her sentence may have been, I don't know, greater if it was. So I assume they were not killed. But yeah, she, I don't know. She's done her time, but she could never be trusted again and should be monitored forever.
I'm sure she will be. I mean, I think about the advancement in technology from when she was arrested to today. I'm sure that her apartment, there's nowhere she can go that she's not being listened to. Yep. And I'm sure that she has to know that, right? I mean, she can't be naive enough to think that, yep, you've done your time, your sentence is over, we're going to not pay attention to you anymore. I'd say someone is probably assigned to Anna.
Yeah, you know? Just like she was assigned to other people. And for those wondering, Puerto Rico is technically a part of the United States. It's been a territory for a really long time. I don't know if we just don't want to break the whole round number of 50 states thing, but she is still living in America.
I wonder if that will change when Greenland becomes 52.
Man, I'm totally kidding.
But I mean, history would tell us that there is a chance that Greenland could become a territory while not officially a
state. And we have a few territories. Maybe we're waiting until we get five territories, then we can have 55 states.
Yeah, I don't know, man. But I mean, in all genuineness, you have to protect yourself. And Cuba is so close that if an ally who wanted to harm us was able to influence Cuba to let them set up shop, that is a direct threat on us. So it does behoove us to have a good relationship with Cuba, to help out however we can, and to monitor what's going on there. I'm not saying we should own it as a state. I'm not saying we should do that to Greenland, but for protection, you do have to be good neighbors.
Right, yeah. And she was trying to be the best neighbor, apparently. I don't know that I believe she didn't take any money. That was never a public record, but I have a hard time believing she took nothing because she was risking everything.
Yeah.
And she needed money to do some of the stuff that she did, so anyway, that's just my speculation.
Her heart may have been wanting to do it for free, but to do it for that long and risk everything, you're getting some money.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree.
Especially when you leave with a duffel bag full of cash.
Yeah, right.
Where did that come from?
Where did that go? I'd be curious to see what others think about this. Like I said, this is, I don't know. America's, we got some mixed opinions. We kind of always have as a country, which is, I think, is what makes us great, of people that are supporting different areas or not supporting different areas. There may be people on Anna's side here. The crossing the line for me was giving the names of the other agents, even though I don't think they were killed, but they could have been. So I don't know. Curious to see if anybody thinks that she was right or if anybody follows her and tries to keep up as she continues to speak out. Like, the story's not over. She's still kicking.
Yeah. It is interesting. I love these kinds of stories. I didn't always love them, to be honest with you, but I don't know. The last few months watching John, what is it again?
Karaku.
Karaku. Just his stories are so intriguing to me, and it kind of lets me know that there are so many more of these stories out there that we may never know. So any chance we get to cover one is great for me.
Yeah, maybe we'll cover him soon and some of his exploits. And yeah, he shares a lot of insider baseball, so we'll see. I mean, if he comes up missing soon, I wouldn't be shocked because he's speaking out a lot.
Would not surprise me.
We appreciate you guys so much and hanging out with us through these cases. We hope that you, wherever you are surviving whatever weather you have, because we're trying to do the same here in Kentucky.
If you are stuck at home and facing the weather or just not able to leave, or you just want to catch up on more podcasts, go check out True Crime Cast on Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, you get a bonus episode each and every month and early ad-free content when available.
I finished the research for February's case last week. Super pumped about that one.
Give us a teaser. What is the case?
Yeah, we're going to look at a murder of an elderly woman who she was stabbed and one of her female tenants was accused of doing it. Did she really do it or was she the scapegoat? We'll dig into that.
It is fascinating. So check out Patreon True Crime Cast to hear that case February 1st.
Yep. Thank you guys. We appreciate you so much.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.